Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to our inaugural quarterly bank strategy call, where today's topic is the best portfolio ideas for banks. I'm Tom O'Hara, head of bank strategy at Amherst Pierpont, and we appreciate everyone making the time to join today. While banks have enjoyed tremendous loan growth so far in 2022, that growth is slowing in some areas for certain loan types, potentially leaving room for more securities portfolio investment in the weeks and months ahead. This year, with all of the Fed rate hikes and the large backup in rates across the curve, values of bank securities portfolios have suffered. Because of this and concern over additional rate hikes, some banks may be opting to keep their securities portfolio duration shorter and may be considering some of the shorter duration options that are available in the ABS space or thinking about taking on more credit risk in the corporate or CLO space. Others may find their balance sheets to be too asset sensitive and are looking to extend duration. Also, because of the balance sheet rotation into higher risk weight loans and away from lower risk weight securities, capital ratios have deteriorated, and that has led some banks to prioritize risk weightings in their securities selection. So we have a great lineup of speakers for you today to discuss their best portfolio ideas in their respective sectors to address some of these specific issues. From our bank strategy team, we have Brian Landy to discuss residential mortgage backs, Mary Beth Fisher to discuss commercial mortgage backs, Dan Brazzo to discuss corporates, Caroline Chen to discuss CLOs, and from the APS trade desk, Tom Anderson to discuss asset-backed securities. And respecting that all of you are very busy, we're going to try to keep this call brief, and I've asked each speaker to cover their top ideas in about 5 minutes, and then after everyone's gone, we'll have some time for Q&A at the end of the call. So with that, let me turn it over to Brian Landy to start with RMBS. Brian?
Thank you, Tom. Good afternoon, everyone, and thanks for taking the time to listen. So mortgage spreads have widened through much of the year, although seem to maybe have found their footing over the last month and a half or so. I think this has put mortgages in a place where they offer better returns, you know, than, you know, potentially a variety of other assets. The return advantage increases at higher coupons. And at those higher coupons, Ginnie Mae MBS look like they have higher projected returns than conventional MBS. So for pass-throughs, I think, you know, higher coupon Ginnies are probably the place to be. And, you know, it also has the added benefit of being zero risk weight securities. And that return advantage also translates to CMOs. And, you know, I'll show a couple of examples using short duration bonds. But first, you know, I'll start with an update on spreads. You know, the mortgage treasury basis is around 165 basis points. That's, you know, tightened a little from the recent wide of about 175 to 180 basis points. Kind of putting that in context, you know, the basis last got to this level at the start of COVID, you know, during a period, which was a period of extreme market stress. And it was even wider than that, say, going all the way back to the 2008 financial crisis. But, you know, the basis did get to these levels in 2011, which was around the first time the Fed allowed its MBS portfolio to run off, and was commonly this wide in the early 2000s. You kind of see a similar pattern, like looking at mortgage OASs, like the current coupon OAS, you know, is at the widest level since COVID and the financial crisis, but prior to the crisis, OASs were routinely wider. And since right now it isn't a period of market stress like 2008 or, you know, the onset of COVID, the current widening is really likely a result of heavy net supply, which comes from heavy turnover, elevated turnover activity and Fed runoff. Now, although turnover is slowing, loan sizes are much higher because of home price appreciation over the last couple of years. So really, net supply comes from both the turnover activity and the size of the loans that are being made. And so that should, so that those larger loans, that should help keep net supply above pre-pandemic levels over the next year, even though turnover is obviously slowing down. And you still have Fed MBS runoff adding to that. So it really doesn't seem likely that spreads, you know, would tighten much from here. There's a lot of supply for private investors to absorb. You know, and overall, the market is just adjusting to one that doesn't have a backstop buyer, you know, which has generally been the Fed since 2008 and arguably the GSE portfolios before then. Now, this widening, though, has an upside because I think now mortgages do look, you know, pretty cheap relative to other assets on a variety of metrics. And, you know, for today, I'll just focus on, you know, I'm going to look at one-year total returns of mortgages versus treasuries to show that advantage. So on the slide, I've got a few graphs. You know, on the top left, it shows the excess one-year total returns of conventional MBS over a portfolio combination of two-year and 10-year treasuries. And so kind of for each coupon, I built a portfolio that has the same duration and market value of that coupon MBS and just show the return advantage over the next year of the MBS versus the portfolio. And then almost every, and you know, across the x-axis are different rate scenarios. In almost every scenario, for every coupon, the MBS is projected to outperform treasuries. Although I say some coupons slightly underperform if rates move up 100 basis points over the next year. I mean, other than that, it's outperformance really everywhere. And so, you know, mortgages have a healthy return advantage, and they actually do a little bit better in a small rally. Spread widening is, you know, really is just more that's happened is just more than enough to overcome, you know, the worst convexity of the MBS relative to treasuries over a wide range of interest rate moves. And also higher coupons tend to outperform lower coupons across all these scenarios. So going up a coupon just increases that return advantage. And again, in that 100 basis point sell-off, lower coupons might outperform a little bit, but really it's, you know, it's just not by much. Higher coupons also have the advantage of reducing spread exposure. Not much reason to expect spreads to tighten, so I think less spread exposure is a good thing. And yeah, you know, so overall higher coupons, largest return advantage, and the least exposure to spread widening. And on the top right, I did the same thing using a Ginnie MBS. The picture is similar to the conventional. Mortgages outperform treasuries across most rate moves, and higher coupons do better than lower coupons. However, the benefit of moving up in coupon is even greater for Ginnies than it is for conventionals. And so kind of moving to the bottom left, I think this chart makes it easier to see. What I did was just take the difference kind of point by point, line by line between those first two charts, taking the Ginnie number minus the Fannie number. And so a positive number is just showing Ginnie outperformance relative to Fannies. And lower coupons, conventionals do better, but in the higher coupons, Ginnies offer a higher total returns over the next year. And there's also overall a little bit, you know, the Ginnies are less negatively convex than conventional MBS. You can kind of see that in the charts. They actually do a little bit better than conventional in a rally. And finally, in the bottom right, I get the same analysis doing excess 1 year total returns. But here I picked a couple of short duration CMOs. One's about a 1.5 year duration. The Ginnie, I think, is around just a little bit over 2 year duration. But like the pass throughs, you know, both of these bonds, you know, they outperform treasuries in all but the highest interest rate scenario. And the Ginnie bond to do just a little bit better than the conventional across the board as well. So I think, you know, putting it all together, higher coupon Ginnie MBS, you know, and that's specifically, you know, 4.5s and above, you know, kind of seem like they're the best place to be overall in pass-throughs. But, you know, high coupon conventional does pretty well too. And the relative value of MBS seems to carry over to structured products. And in this case, shows up in, you know, nice projected excess returns in the example CMOs. And thank you. With that, I'll pass the call back to Tom.
Okay, great. Thanks very much, Brian. And we are starting to get some questions in that Q&A box in the lower right corner. So if anyone has any questions, just a reminder to put them there, and we'll try to get to some of those at the end of the call, time allowing. Now to talk about CMBS strategy, I'll turn it over to Mary Beth Fisher.
Hey, Tom. Thanks so much. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. So if you've been following our head of investment strategy, Steve Abrahams, you would know that his outlook on the residential mortgage market, the residential housing market, is that we will be home prices will be stagnant to down very, very modestly over the next year or two. And part of his reasoning is that there aren't any forced It's very unusual to have for sellers in this environment and for homeowners who don't typically have to turn over their properties. Unfortunately, that's not at all true in commercial real estate, where the loans are typically 10 years. They have balloon maturities. They are forced to refinance or sell the property at the end of the 10-year term. And pretty much the entire universe of loans of commercial real estate loans that are maturing over the next 3 years are going to be forced to do that at much higher rates. So we do expect to see some more property price depreciation that's already started this year. Depending on which commercial real estate index you follow, property prices are down 3%. If you look at backward looking indices, they're down as much as 13%. If you look at some forward looking indices, that's Green Street Property Price Index, which just updated this week. So the rating agencies have looked at commercial real estate. If you look at non-agency CRE transactions, they're preparing to do some modest but some downgrades, particularly mostly confined to lower rated tranches. So there is going to be some credit deterioration. It's not, no one expects it to be widespread to my knowledge, but it's coming over the next year to 3 years. So from that perspective, we strongly, our top recommendation for bank portfolios is to stay in agency CMBS. And there's kind of two sides to that, which is obviously Ginnie Mae project loans, Ginnie Mae securities with that are fully government guaranteed are a great place to be. There's 0% risk weighting. Any credit risk that develops is not going to flow through to the investor. So what we would what looks the best there right now is par coupon or as close as you can get to par coupon, maybe very slightly discounted current origination Ginnie Mae project loan deals. The reason you want to look at current originations is those have already been, those are at current rates. They're being underwritten to the higher rate standards. So the DSCRs are robust. The loan to values are robust. The underwriters are looking forward to see how the property can manage the debt service. Typically now, Fannie, Freddie, and Ginnie are also lowering the maximum LTV a little bit in their properties. So that's a positive for credit. And also it's a positive for the borrowers. So all of that is good going forward. And those loans at current levels, if, as rates continue to rise, certainly you're not going to have any prepayments from par coupons, par coupon Ginnie Mae project loans, and they're still in the lockout period anyway. So even if you had some, like most of the time, you're going to have a 1 year to 2 year lockout period, particularly from the construction loans. So these are all going to be very stable profiles. The other part of sector of Ginnie Mae project loans that you can consider, and this is if you are willing to go into some not super deep discount paper, but deeper, certainly not par paper, is look at 2017 to 2018 vintage Ginnie Mae project loans. The reason you want to look at these is they're at a discount, and those vintage loans are starting to prepay faster because they benefited from the big run-up in property prices, and it's very easy for those borrowers, as their prepayment penalties fall, to sell the property. And we've already seen last month these vintage loans start to prepay at 9 CPR. So when you have discount paper that's starting to getting prepays coming through, you actually get a very meaningful bump in performance, and you get the additional yield from that. So those are the two sectors that we like in Ginnie Mae project loans. For other people who are ready to start thinking about extending in duration and want to get some diversification, we like Freddie Mac's small balance fixed rate loans. You can do these in the 5 year tranches. If you're not ready to go out in duration, that's a good place to be right now. And as the Fed continues to raise rates and we potentially get to 5% and 5.25, that's the point where we would really consider extending all the way out into 7 and 10 year duration for Freddie K's or Freddie small balance loans. Right now, before you extend in duration, we still recommend staying very short, and that would be using Freddie K floater deals and Fannie Mae SARMs, structured ARMs. Both of those great in the floating rate space. You get very good liquidity there. They tend to be prepay faster anyway, so they tend to be 3 to 5 year maturity, even though, you know, they might have a 10 year final on them. So we like those. You can always fix them if you like fixed rate versus floating rate. You can actually just do a swap on top of it if you like doing that strategy. We have some clients that do that significantly, especially in the SARM product. And that's a good place to be while we're waiting for the Fed to kind of get to the top of this cycle. And that is it from me, and I'll pass it back to Tom.
All right, great. Thanks very much, Mary Beth. So now to talk about corporate bond strategy, we'll turn it over to Dan Bruzzo.
Hey, thanks a lot, Tom. Good afternoon, everyone. Just shifting focus to corporate credit for a couple minutes. With the recent historic moves in rates and the persistently inverted treasury curve, we've seen the dynamics of the corporate bond market change pretty considerably over the last couple of months. Investment-grade corporate bond spreads hit a new local wide on October 12th, with the IG index closing at a level of plus 165 OAS. We've tightened a little bit since then, but this was the highest we had seen spreads go since June of 2020, obviously during the height of the pandemic. Meanwhile, the corporate primary market has proved somewhat inconsistent over the past two-plus months. Issuers have been struggling to navigate day-to-day swings in market sentiment, not so much this week, but certainly limited. We've seen some limited new supply and issuers being forced in some cases to either postpone or even indefinitely delay their new bond deals over the past couple of weeks. So with less consistent options available via the primary calendar, we think it serves investors right now well to consider alternative strategies in the secondary market. And specifically, I'm talking about weighing the alternatives of either adding credit risk or adding duration risk. So if we look at slide five here, in the first two graphs up top, we took a look at historical yield yield available over the past 12 years for a couple of different extension trade options. The two that we have depicted here are the three to five-year extension in the top left and a 5 to 7-year extension in the top right of the slide. As you can pretty plainly see, the flat intermediate yield curve is pretty evident in the historical data. And that I mean that in the first of these options, an investor can add just 15 basis points for a move from 3-year maturity to 5-year maturity. So that compares with a 12-year average of about 60 basis points for the same move. So we're well below a full standard deviation of the mean in that trade. Likewise, on the top right, an extension trade from 5-year maturity to 7-year maturity is offering right now just right around 9 basis points of incremental yield. And that compares with a 12-year average of about 51 basis points. So we're actually currently 2 full standard deviations from the mean in the 5 to 7-year extension. So among the options in those first two, yes, the 3 to 5-year trade is offering the better yield grab historically, but we believe investors in credit are better suited to seek yield through down and credit strategies versus taking on the additional duration in these first two trade strategies. So on the second half, the bottom half of the slide, we see two of these strategies. The first is a historical study showing the available spread differential between double A and single A credit over the past 12 years. This is according to Bloomberg Fair Value Curves indices. Investors can currently earn about 52 basis points of spread to move down in credit from double A to single A. That level compares with an average spread pick of about 32 basis points over the past 12 years. So in this case, we are a full standard deviation above the mean for this particular down in credit strategy. This is actually near the highest level of additional risk compensation we've seen since the height of the pandemic, and it's one of the highest levels relative to the mean over the entire 12-year horizon that's presented here. So this one appears the most attractive option right now for investors if you're looking to achieve some incremental yield relative to the historical relationship in the study. And then lastly, if you look on the bottom right hand, we can see the spread available for a trade from single A credit to triple B credit, again, stretched out over the past 12 years. And according to Bloomberg Fair Value Indices for each rating category, currently earning about 53 basis points of spread to move down in credit to triple B from single A. On an historic basis, the average spread pick is about 59 basis points. So currently investors are earning just under the average on this additional credit risk. This option does compare favorably, obviously, to the extension trades illustrated above, but not nearly as historically attractive as the current compensation you're getting to move from double A to single A. So just bringing it around to some real-world examples of actionable double A to A trade suggestions that you can do right now in the corporate space. Looking at Cisco Systems rated A1 AA minus. Cisco Systems 26s trade at a level of around 25 to the 5-year. Alternatively, you could trade into Booking Holdings, staying in the tech sector, rated A3 A minus. The Booking 26s with similar coupon traded a level of 99 to the 5-year. So in this case, you'd be saying roughly same duration, pick 74 basis points, moving down from AA to single A credit, staying in tech. Another example, moving over to the financial sector, CME Group. CME Group is AA3, AA minus rated. CME 10 years traded at a level of about 112 to the 10-year. Very close comp in that space, in the exchange space, is Cboe Global Markets. That's A3, A minus rated. Similar coupon, 10 years, traded at a level of 152 to the 10-year. So that's about a 40 basis point pick there, and staying, again, in very similar sector context. So, again, just to recap, very attractive AA to A pickup right now historically. Offers up an alternative strategy versus extension trades in corporates, which currently are providing very little in terms of spread pickup for the additional duration risk that you're taking on. So that's it for me. So I'm going to pass the call back over to Tom. Thank you.
Excellent, Dan. Thank you. So now to talk about CLO strategy, we have Carolyn Chan.
Thank you, Tom. Good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for dialing into our bank strategy call. I'm Caroline, and I cover CLO. Banks have played a critical role in CLO investor base. Looking ahead, CLO will remain a viable investment strategy for banks. And we particularly like the top of CLO capital stack for banks for a couple of reasons. First, the rating stability of highly rated CLO bonds. It is true that the CLO rating performance are generally more volatile than their corporate counterparts. For example, during the economic boom, CLO upgrades tend to outpace corporate upgrades. But during an economic downturn, CLO downgrades also outpace corporate downgrades. However, most CLO downgrades are driven by BBB or below rated tranches. So the top left side of the slide show the S&P downgrades during the pandemic time. There were a total of 471 broadly syndicated loan CLO tranches downgraded from July to December 2020, 289 in the corporate sector during the same period. But CLO downgrades, as you can see from the chart, were highly concentrated in lower rated tranches. The number of downgrades in both AA and single A in both broadly syndicated loan and the middle market CLOs were lower than corporates at comparable ratings. So how this past rating performance will relate to the future economic downturn? Well, in recent S&P study, the agency assumes 5% of loan issuers going to default, and the CCC exposure in broadly syndicated loan CLO will increase to 10%. In this scenario, S&P will see a modest number of CLO tranches. Mostly they are pre-2020 CLOs. Double B and single B tranches will be lowered by one or two notches. Most of the AAA and most of the AA will remain intact in this scenario. In the middle market CLO, S&P also runs a couple of stress scenarios, and the BB again is the most vulnerable tranche to collateral loss, with rating downgrades from 1 to 6 notches. And the AA tranches will have one notch downgrade in most severe stress scenarios. So for banks has always been keen on their capital charges, the rating stability at the top of U.S. CLO capital stack is really an important fact for banks' investors to consider. Second, the floating coupon in most CLOs should help investors to ride the rising rate wave. Now, my colleague Mary Beth just touched this point before. Most securitized products are fixed rate, and the floating rate feature of the CLO products really stands out, especially if banks have liability funding that was floating as well. Lastly, the top of the CLO capital stack provides good carry to investors. The top right table on the slides show both yield and the spread change year-to-date for CLOs and other securitized products and corporates. CLO spread widened along with broad fixed income market. But from both yield and OAS perspective, broadly syndicated loan CLO AAA year to date the change just really outside the most securitized products as well as corporate IG. With most AAA have widened to above 200 basis points over SOFR since the second half of this year, we just think the carry will remain very attractive to our bank investors. So to recap, we think the top of the capital stack is really attractive to our bank investors for rating stability reasons, floating rate instruments, and higher carry. With that, I give back to Tom.
All right, great. Well, thank you, Caroline. So last but not least, and to talk about asset-backed securities from our trade desk, we have Tom Anderson.
Hey, thanks, Tom. Good afternoon, everybody. So we're going to discuss a few different profiles here this afternoon in the consumer asset-backed security market. Both options here are rather robust from a collateral and sponsor servicer view as well as structural. We're going to start with a more vanilla asset class. It has the best liquidity in the market. It's bank-originated general-purpose credit cards. Credit card ABS provides credit card issuers like Bank of America, Citi, Chase, Discover, with a method to reduce their funding costs by moving these accounts off their books and into the hands of investors through special-purpose vehicles, so otherwise the ABS trust. So why do we like credit card ABS here? There's actually a pretty interesting duration mismatch where we have a short duration receivable that's held within a longer duration vehicle. There's strong sponsorship by the issuing bank, and these typically come in a variety of weighted average life profiles. Most of the primary market activity that you see today is at the three-year part of the curve, but these have been issued anywhere from a two-year out to a 20-year term in most cases over the years, just depending on what the rates market looks like. Lastly, these have a bullet structure, which really eliminates issues of taking a view on prepayment speeds like most consumer ABS. So on the topic of duration, unlike most ABS deals that exhibit a static pool of receivables that result in a similar duration ABS structure, the credit card ABS structure is under a master trust where the underlying receivables are changing every month as credit card balances are paid down. So general purpose credit cards, which are predominantly prime FICO borrowers, exhibit pretty healthy payment rates. So the monthly payment rates on these balances range around the 20 to 30%, which would on its own translate to a 3 to 4 month duration on their own. And consequently, if there was ever underperformance with an early amortization event on these trusts, the investors would actually be only exposed to performance deterioration for a relatively short period of time, just as these things pay down in a really quick fashion. And on that topic of performance deterioration, the issuer also has the ability to change terms on the receivables, and they can actively manage these accounts based on purchase and payment behavior as well as credit bureau information. So if they deem an account to be of higher credit risk, they can lower the limits on the credit card as well as increase the APR. And if you look back towards the Great Financial Crisis, the underlying performance on these trusts actually fared pretty well. And all things considered, these are unsecured consumer receivables. As you look on the slide, we look at the excess spread through early 2000s and through the crisis, and you can see that the excess spread is the first layer of defense against losses. And as charge-offs increased through the crisis, excess spread was penalized from 15% down to about 5% for a period of 2 years, which is about a 65% decline. But when you look at the actual monthly payment rates, they only dropped by about 25%. And that was due to the banks actually stepping in and managing the collateral that was moving in and out of these master trusts, which resulted really only in about 2% of the credit card universe being downgraded on average 2 to 3 notches, specifically by Fitch, between 08 and 2011. And while these receivables are bankruptcy remote from the issuer, the investor is relying significantly on the servicer and the sponsor, which brings in corporate risk. So on that note, taking a look at the table on the right, we want to compare what the ABS deal looks like versus its unsecured corporate counterpart, where it's applicable. So in this case, we're looking at American Express unsecured corporates versus the American Express credit card ABS structure. There's a decent arb here, and I would say that there's definitely relative value to be shown where you have a triple B rated corporate bond versus a triple A rated ABS bond, which yields basically a pretty attractive delta on RWA for a modest 18 basis points, 20 basis points in credit spread delta. And what's interesting here is that while the ABS structure is certainly strong and why it achieves a AAA rating, it's actually widened out more than the corporate unsecured profiles have as well this year. So I think there's a decent relative value here for the credit card space as well. And last thing I would add is just given the structure, being a bullet maturity, you have, you know, with consumer liabilities in general in this environment, you tend to see more extension risk in some products like MBS, lack of refis, et cetera. This is a good alternative to looking at a three-year part of the curve, or if you can find something a longer duration, if you like, to have some security and knowing that that's what that average life is going to ultimately end up at. The next topic that we'll talk about here is rate reduction bonds, a.k.a. Utility bonds. And this is a real interesting story, just given the receivables supporting these securities. The rate reduction bond is really just a securitization of cash flow stream generated by a fee charged to utility customers. And this fee is a line item. On their utility bill, it can be around 5% of their monthly bill. And the utility companies were actually granted a right by the state legislation to charge consumers this fee, really to recover costs associated with their stranded assets. So in order to securitize this payment stream, just like the credit card receivables, the utility company has to move these off into an SPV, which ultimately issues the notes or the bonds. So why do we like this asset class, and why is it so interesting? So the securitized receivable is really just – it's inelastic. And what we mean by that is this fee is not scaled to any level of energy consumption by the user. Additionally, users can't segregate this fee from their monthly bill, as it would be considered a delinquent account at that point. So, in other words, the monthly receivable that is securitized here is actually pretty sticky. These deals also benefit from a true-up mechanism, which allows for the consumer charges to be adjusted up or down in order to amend any shortfalls or surpluses experienced by the trust. So this true-up mechanism actually makes the repayment schedule more predictable than probably any other ABS asset class in the universe here, just given the ability to manipulate how much that receivable is coming and going. So on a ratings and duration basis, these trade at pretty attractive spreads on a credit spread basis while taking into consideration the quality of the structure and the receivable relative to most AAA ABS universe as well as the corporate comps. Additionally, these are not high volume asset classes. They have, I would say they come in waves. We've seen more just given the more natural disasters that have occurred over the last few years, which drives these recovery bond issuances. You've seen it from California, you've seen it in Kansas here, which is going to be our example. You may see some more, like if you think back to Katrina years back, recovery bonds were issued off of that. So there's, because of the low volume in the space, there is definitely a liquidity premium that gets added to these, which makes it even that much more attractive relative to the underlying fundamentals. So for example, Kansas Gas Service Utility Company, it's in the market this week. It was a recovery bond for winter storm that hit last year, had some pretty big infrastructure impacts. And the parent company, which is One Gas Incorporated, is a traded corporate debt with a single A rating. And I would say the story here is you're looking at a 10-year maturity on the corporate. It's a 10-year window on the ABS bond. Ultimately, it's a 5-year average life. But you're getting similar credit spread for half the rate duration. You get a better rating, a secured asset in this case, and likely better RWA treatment as well. So from a bank's perspective, I think that there's decent ARB there. So I'll leave it at that. I'll turn it back over to Tom O'Hara. Thank you so much for your time.
Okay, great. Thanks, Tom. Don't go too far. So we that wraps up the speaker part of this presentation. We have gotten a bunch of different questions in, and we're not going to have time to go through all of those, but I thought what we would do is just distill the list down and maybe just one for each of our speakers, and we'll start with Tom. So, Tom, one question that came in regarding cards. Many of the card banks are putting up much larger provisions now versus the bank industry as a whole. And, while you're talking about the top of the capital stack at AAA, what impact would recession-driven consumer stress have on the bonds from a spread perspective?
Sure. So, I mean, we can think about our most recent example through COVID. On the early days of COVID, we had obviously a liquidity event in most fixed income funds. fundamentals proved to be strong through the consumer. Obviously, we saw that through fiscal stimulus. But otherwise, what we saw initially move, and credit cards being the most liquid asset in the ABS market, those are the first ones to go when people raise cash. So we saw a technical widening there, call it 50 to 70 basis points within the first, you know, call it 4 to 5 weeks of COVID and the market shutting down. But generically, I think that these things hold, these profiles hold in extremely well, and that's driven by the changes in underwriting since the great financial crisis that banks have undergone with credit card acts, et cetera, improving how this business is run, and just given the type of consumer that is getting these. So we have a bifurcated market where general purpose credit cards are really reserved for the prime consumer, where more non-prime run by more especially finance companies issuing credit cards there. So in general, you know, you can expect to see, depending on duration here, these bonds to hold value within the 90s dollar price. These were some of the most attractive assets during the financial crisis because of what the banks were able to do to keep the continuity of the trusts, and those came back really quickly, back to parity with where they were before 08.
Got it. Okay, great. Thanks very much, Tom. So next question comes for Caroline Chen in the CLO space. Caroline, what's caused the larger CLO spread widening this year relative to some of the other products, and do we think that could continue?
Sure. Thanks for that question. It's a good question. I think CLO widened in general just with broad fixed income market, but there's lots of technical reasons behind it more than fundamental. We highlight, you know, the Japanese bank exit in the past research paper, the aged warehouse, because, you know, the overhang of the aged warehouse issues. But bear in mind that, you know, loans in those aged warehouse is not that they have fundamental credit problem or issues. It's just the market price volatility. And also the bank investors largely are on the sideline this year because last year was a record issuance year. Bank has started to purchase lots of CL paper last year, but they tended to be on the sideline for this year given the market volatility. So I think there's lots of technical factors behind it for the spread widening. I mean, it's true we're going to start to see more and more headline risk regarding the leverage loan defaults or high yield defaults in this particular area, but bear in mind that the defaults in underlying loans versus defaults in the CL tranche, they are totally different. You know, our strategy head, Steve, had a piece this week on Monday, you know, just give a very brief overview about the leverage loan performance in general. So we do see the you know, the credit defaults, you know, triple C share, they start to rise, but it's not like, fundamentally you're gonna see next year, just like a rating agency stress, you're gonna see 20%, 30% defaults coming up. So with that being said, I think a CLO, most likely you're gonna start still to see the credit curve getting steepened, especially in the double B sectors. You're going to see wide spread divergence. But for most of the top of the capital stack, I think especially the AAA, there will still be range bound spread trading.
Okay, great. Well, thank you, Caroline. So the next question comes for Dan Bruzzo in corporates. Dan, how long would you expect the value in that single A trade to persist before reverting back to the mean?
That's a good question. Judging historically, there, you know, the spikes, when you get above a full standard deviation of the mean, they don't last particularly long. But, you know, we're in a bit of a different market environment now. You know, I think it could be anywhere from a couple of weeks to a couple of months, but I do expect it to be relatively short-lived. One of the sort of a related question I had gotten when I had presented this idea elsewhere is, you know, to what extent Credit Suisse and the Yankee banks, the difficulties that they've been having more recently, to what extent that's weighing in on single A, let's say, affordability right now. It's definitely putting a little bit of pressure on spreads, but
We've seen Credit Suisse CDS gap in 100 basis points without really moving the needle. So I wouldn't say necessarily that's, you know, this is a bank-specific trade idea. And, in fact, most of the real-world examples of trades that I thought were particularly attractive were away from the banking sector. So, yeah, it'll more than likely be a pretty short-lived, at least this at this order of magnitude, above a full standard deviation of the mean. You know, I wouldn't necessarily say it's, again, that it's something that's being overly influenced by what's going on in the banking sector more recently.
Got it. Thanks. Okay, great. Thank you, Dan. So next question comes from Mary Beth Fisher on CMBS. And Mary Beth, this was related to one of your recommendations regarding Ginnie Mae project loans, where you're recommending either current coupon or 2017-2018 vintage. And could you just speak briefly about the relative advantages or disadvantages of current coupon versus the older vintage?
Yeah, absolutely. It's really the relative difference in those two trades is that you are trying to position for very different outcomes. If you think of the par coupon, the current origination Ginnie Mae project loans, the loans that are in those pools have been taken out really at the close to the peak of the market pricing, because we peaked at property prices peaked in December, January, maybe very, very early first quarter of this year, again, depending on what index you follow. And so now those loans have been taken out at the peak, and you have close to par coupon loans. Now, when you have a par coupon or a premium bond, obviously, you really want to hold on to it. You don't want your principal back. So eventually, when the Fed starts to lower interest rates, people who bought the property or refinanced the property, took out equity to refinance at the top of the market, I think over time, 3 years, 4 years from now, they're actually going to have less of an incentive to refinance the loan, even when rates go lower, because they're not going to have as much of an equity build depending on what the trajectory of CMBS prices is. So you're actually possibly going to get some protection in those par coupon loans from future prepays, at least in the first few years. Now, in the 2017-2018 vintage loans, Ginnie Mae project loans, which are at a discount, you want those to prepay. Like, if you buy a security at $95, you want it to come back to you at $100 as fast as humanly possible. Tomorrow would be great. So that's what you're seeing in the 2017 to 2018 vintage, which is they have a lot of price appreciation. They are prepaying at a 9 CPR, and they are deeply out of the money. People are selling those properties or refinancing to unlock equity because they have so much property price appreciation. So it's two different sides of the same coin, and both of those are really good strategies, we think, going forward.
Got it. All right, great. Thanks, Mary Beth. So time for one more question. Last question for Brian Landy. How does the current projected outperformance of Ginnie Mae relative to the GSEs compare to historical norms?
Hi, I would say in general, you often have, the Ginnies tend to look a little bit rich relative to conventionals. I mean, there's just a strong overseas bid for Ginnies, for the full faith and credit guarantee. There's extra demand for the zero risk weight, nature of the assets as well. Well, that's not always the case. I mean, there's, the Ginny borrowers, or whether FHA or VA, can have different prepayment profiles from each other versus conventional. I mean, so it kind of depends on how the market and models are pricing in those differences. I mean, like, for example, during COVID, there was certainly a lot of worry about early buyouts out of Ginny Mae bonds. But, in fact, that's not really, I'd say, much of a concern right now with most of the market trading at a discount. Our servicers aren't really going to want to buy out loans like that. So I think that, those sorts of things vary over time. But just in general, I mean, if everything is sort of, being kind of taken into, all the prepayment differences are being taken into account, I think just the extra demand for Ginnies typically makes them, look a little bit rich and not perform quite as well as conventional. So I'd say that's kind of the historical norm, which, maybe a little bit different than right now.
Yeah. Got it. Okay. Thanks very much, Brian. So That's it, everyone. I want to thank all of our speakers for the time they spent thinking through these ideas and putting the materials together and the time presenting today. We got several good ideas on this call here today. So if you have any questions, please reach out to your APS salesperson. And I want to thank everyone who dialed in today. So have a great afternoon, everyone.